Can we then go to labor research services? Labor research service. That will be presented by Ms. Michelle Tao. Okay, yes. Over to you, ma'am. You're welcome.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for this opportunity to add to your considerations in this matter from the work that we've done. My name is Michelle Tao. I work for the Labour Research Service. We're an independent research organisation with trade union membership consisting of 14 unions with combined membership of about 1.8 million workers. In the matter of this merger...
I must say, Michelle, if I were to call you that aloud. Okay. I must say you are a relief to our ears. Ever since a day before yesterday, we've been listening to male voices, and this is quite actually a relief to some of us. Not to say they were not appreciated, but I think that voice, it sort of humbles me because I've been longing to hear from a woman.
Thank you.
You may continue, ma'am. They want to know that the presentation is written Labour Research Service. You don't have copies. Are you okay now? Do you have the documents? Members? Yes. Okay. You may continue, Michelle. But looking at the first page, I think your paragraph after 1.3, those paragraphs following 1.3, paragraph number 2 and 3, might be getting into the merits of the whole thing, and I really wanted to avoid that.
Chairperson, I've kind of reworked it since that ruling was made, so what I'm going to say is not directly what was in the submission we made before we discovered the judicial process. I've tried to rework it, but please check me if I overstep the mark.
All right, thank you, Madam. Okay.
Given South Africa's biggest challenges are by far the massive levels of unemployment, poverty, and inequality, any decisions that are made regarding foreign investment, mergers, and takeovers should be judged in the light of how they assist South Africa and all countries impacted by such a transaction in dealing with these issues. Merger moments, moments of change, are moments when we have, more than others perhaps, the opportunity to take decisive actions to define what we want in terms of employment and development, not simply to try and avoid negative impacts, but try actively to make those impacts better. In terms of employment, our area of focus, better would mean not just more jobs, but decent work for all workers affected, and improved opportunities for others to enjoy the wealth of the nation. Not a moment when we make it harder to achieve that than it was before. What should be set up in the face of mergers is a system that does not leave us hoping that stories of violation and abuses that have occurred in other locations will not happen here, but grant us the opportunity to both improve the lives of those impacted by the merger and perhaps influence back into other parts of the merged entities. Our concern is that we sit here having to make submissions on what would protect us from the former, because we have a hunch that companies will not behave decently until they are forced, and that such consequences for our economic development could be serious. Following the publication of the initial offer to purchase the entire share capital of Massmart in September 2010, the Labour Research Service was commissioned by Uni Global Union to complete research on the structure and operations of Massmart and the conditions of workers in the group in order to understand the context of the deal for workers within the takeover target, bearing in mind that at this time It was still a takeover rather than a merger. In essence, we looked at the impact of the merger before the merger was finalized. The research shows that the reason perhaps that we have a hunch that there's a danger in these mergers for our country is because the impact of the merger has already been felt by workers in last March. Our research cannot predict what will happen after the merger is finalized, except insofar as the actions of the company in the lead-up to the merger. The research found evidence that shop floor workers at Massmart experienced high level of victimization and a hardening of management attitudes. It is noted that when Walmart started sniffing around in 2008, the management of Massmart made it clear that they were available for sale, becoming an attractive target for Walmart or other possible buyers. The strategy that companies implement is over a number of years rather than over a number of months, and it makes it clear that their actions in this regard are evidence of what companies consider it takes to be globally competitive, and how this must be taken into account when all mergers are proposed. Is decent work the price of global competitiveness, and is global competitiveness in this sense the proper engine for economic development? Our concern following the research, which included an analysis of company documents, statements made by management concerning the place of workers in the deal, and interviews with shop floor workers in the company, which we have submitted to the hearing, is that companies looking to be purchased by global players and therefore to become globally competitive are one to view global competitors in a very limited way, which is to the cost of workers that are not strategic decision makers, benefiting only those who make the deals on behalf of shareholders and of themselves, and that the impact of these mergers then is to benefit these groups in particular. In a statement concerning the preparedness for a takeover, CEO of Massmart noted in 2009, it was our strategy to be bought by a global retailer. We didn't have to wonder how we were going to deal with it, or whether our shareholders would like it, or whether management would come along. These were the two main considerations. And it is unlikely that either of these stakeholders would have complained, as over the years, dividend payouts to shareholders had increased to a percentage of profit of almost 45%. It is noteworthy that in 2009, when workers went on strike for a 460 rand increase, the company paid a record 867 million rand to dividends. Excuse me?
Okay,
I'm just looking for a spot to start. While shareholders and management have been brought along on the deal, other workers are an issue to be dealt with. These workers knew nothing officially of the plan until September 2010. However, the preparation for the takeover was a felt reality for workers, particularly in the 3 years leading up to the official offer. At the Gordon Institute of Business Science presentation, the CEO of Massmart stated in February that this is a really exciting time for employees. And just so you are absolutely clear, our employees aren't driving any protest. You'll see there has been no strike, no protests. In fact, I would suggest they have gone so far as to tell the union not to get in the way. All good for our employees. What this statement avoids is that there have been labor unhappiness at Massmart for the preceding 2 years concerning wages and conditions, as has been reported in both Massmart annual reports for 2009 and for 2010. We are not here talking about the retrenched workers, as that is not the remit of this committee. Patterson's statement does this speak to the current workers at Massmart and the conditions under which they have been progressively working. Which workers he spoke to find out how happy they were, we don't know. Perhaps his own management colleagues. Or did he speak to the vast majority of some 30,000 workers at Massmart, 38% of whom are represented by a single union? The Labour Research Service did speak to these workers, and 3 points became apparent. These workers did want the union to be involved because they were being increasingly victimized by mass management in what they then understood back in 2008 and 9 to be a long-term strategy. The general mood was that participants felt that due to the takeover, they felt intimidated in the workplace by the fact that they could lose their job and livelihood in an instant. They believed that this situation was created so that by the time of any merger, workers would already be working in an intimidating environment, an environment in which they remained for the very reasons stated by the CEO of Massmart when he said, "I suppose it would be fair to say that an employer of Massmart can well say, at least it's us that got bought by Walmart. So if it's true that competitors are going to suffer and suppliers are going to suffer, the employees of Massmart should be fine." The statement itself makes no sense. Either competitors and suppliers are going to suffer or they are not. And if they are going to suffer, by the time the merger happens, the evidence suggests that labour relations are already strained and working conditions sacrificed for global attractiveness. The knock-on effect, which therefore feeds onto how other companies will try and achieve the same attractiveness, cannot be predicted but could be imagined. The downgrading of working conditions for the lowest paid workers in particular is contrary to South Africa's economic development through decent work. Development begins on the shop floor and cannot be achieved when workers are increasingly pressurized to be flexible, to accept lower conditions and general uncertainty concerning their livelihoods in both good and bad times. It must be concerned with advancing the social and economic welfare of those workers. In the face of mergers, takeovers, and the like, processes must therefore be put in place to ensure not simply for a limited period of time, but as a matter of economic principle, that workers can defend their rights in companies and impact on how those companies are governed. So when we worry about what mergers might mean for the economic development of this country, evidence already suggests that we are right to be worried, and that some of the damage has already been done and needs to be addressed. We therefore recommend that pressure to be put not just on Walmart, but on all entities entering this country, that they allocate resources to enter into meaningful social dialogue with workers and unions in order to achieve the goal of decent work by including workers in policy and process engagements. Further, that a centralized bargaining forum be established so workers can together address their issues with the company. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michelle. Quite difficult, but I thought you made it okay. Members, here's the submission from Ms. Michelle Tao. I'm going to note, I'm noting Mr. Mare, Babintuli, I'm Babu Mabasa, sorry. Yes. Mr. Mara.
Thank you very much, Chair. Can I just ask them, there's quite a few allegations that you have now made where you say that, for instance, jobs will be downgraded. Am I correct in saying that, if you've said that? I just want to make sure, on what do you base that? On assumptions? At what will happen in the future? Or is that something that has already happened? Because as far as I know, the merger is still pending and is still sub judice and is still a matter for the courts. The second one is, you've referred again
to... So you'll agree with me that you shouldn't answer that?
But you allowed her to say. You allowed
she
her
she
to
referred to the research. That's why I'm saying I allowed her to talk about that, just in terms of the research.
Okay, but this is also general, because I asked whether
but this is directly linked to the case before. before the appeal court? The way you're asking it, unless you rephrase.
I rephrase it and say, allegations that you've made, is that based on assumptions or facts? The second one is the views that you have expressed about mergers and transactions like this. From whose perspective is that? Is that your own perspective? Is that an objective perspective from an independent body? Because we need to know, because quite a number of things that you have said is quite contrary to what the competition tribunal found and published in their documents. So it's absolutely contrary to that. So I just want to know from what perspective that was done. And then in terms of what we have got in our system, do you have any suggestions then to the competition authorities of how they are doing it right? Do you have faith in them? And do you acknowledge their independence? And then the other one, Madam Chair, she has specifically talked about, you allowed her to talk about the employees of Massmart. Can I ask a question on that, on their BEE, whether she's acquainted with their BEE statement?
As long as you don't move away from the context under which she was raised, because you must remember she indicated that this was work given to the Labour Research Service. Before.
I just want to know whether she's acquainted with the benefits that the workers of Massmart has received so far from their BEE transactions and commitments. And I can give you the figures if you want to, if you don't have it. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mr. Mare. Babe Mabasa.
Thank you, Correct Chair, and also echoing your appreciation on the gender basis. I also want to ask a question where huge monopoly companies invade a country, they usually concentrate on profit maximization at whatever cost. Typically, what are the areas that are incurred by the hosting country from the cost perspective, which may not have been articulated by the incoming monopoly company at the moment of coming? So that the moment of talk differs from the practice. That's the one question. And then the second question is when it comes to businesses that are struggling to survive in the rural areas as well as township and informal settlement areas, do you think that the coming in of a huge monopoly, in the way I'm speaking, will assist such businesses to thrive, or will you think it is going to kill such small businesses? And then the third, last one would be, what is the net effect on families? I'm referring here to dependents of the employee or the worker, and I'm also referring to the extended family. When a monopoly enters a country and swallows the small existing companies. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Bob Mabas. Any other question?
chairperson. I'll try to respond. On the first question of so-called allegations that jobs have been downgraded or will be downgraded, I don't want to overstep the mark. The information that we have came from interviews and focus groups of current workers on their current situation, not on what might happen in the future. Our research is about the lead-up to a merger and what companies do to themselves to make themselves attractive. So I'm not making allegations about what will happen after the merger. I'm talking about the lead-up to the merger. So these are not allegations. These are reports of interviews from current workers. I'd be interested to know which views I am stating that are contrary to current findings, because unless I have some content on that, it's hard for me to respond to the fact that my views are other than the currently held views on mergers. Whether I have faith in the competition authorities, from a personal perspective or from a Labour Research Service perspective, I do have faith in the competition authorities, but their remit is quite narrow, and I think the understanding of what global competitiveness is needs to be broadened to include decent work as part of being globally competitive. On the BBBEE deal, we do have information of that. However, it was not part of our remit to look at the BEE deal of Massmart. We looked specifically at the conditions of work at Massmart and also at the dividend payouts and the director's fees of Massmart in the lead up to the merger. So that was not really part of the work that we looked at. Dealing with the question of monopolies, talk versus practice, businesses in rural areas suffering, and the net effect on families of incoming monopolies. Again, it is difficult to predict what will happen when a monopoly comes in. There is evidence from other countries, but that has been made available to the competition authorities before this hearing. I will say that the downgrading of jobs at any company will have an effect on the families of the workers in those companies.
Thank you. Ma'am Sotetse?
Thank you, Chair. In your research, can you give example of a few countries where Walmart has contributed to the growth of SMEs and to job creation as well?
Any other question? Okay, you may answer, Michelle.
Sorry, I make my apologies again. Our focus was specifically on Massmart in this regard, not on Walmart. And so I can only speak from the perspective of our research on Massmart as a company. I do apologize for that.
Thank you. Any follow-up? All right. In the absence of further questions, I guess, Michelle, we want to thank you very much for your presentation. And we will then continue to the next presenter. The next presenter would be Mr. Stain is still not in. Okay, I'm skipping. Can we get from the Law Review Project, Mr. Law? Department ready? Okay, just want to find out if Mr. Lu is still around. You know, just coming in different names. No, he just expressed an interest in making oral representation, and we gave him that opportunity. Mr. Lowe, the floor is yours.
You are a hype man.
You belong to various organizations. Okay.
Sorry, there was some confusion about one newspaper report gave the impression that these hearings would be postponed. When I read it again, I saw it was ambiguous. I'm actually meant to be on leave, and I have flu, and my colleagues flew, and one of them's overseas, and people in the two organizations. I wasn't meant to be officially one of the people giving evidence, but in the end, for reasons, I manned the pumps, and I'm doing both. So I'm now a different human being, a different person, and I'll present the Law Review Project submission, which is purely jurisprudential, doesn't go into economics.
So are you an alien now?
I'm now an alien. Yes, Madam
okay.
Chair. I look the same, but it's just actually my twin brother. This is really, in a sense, what I suppose was considered to be a truly legitimate thing for your committee to be doing at this time, namely to revisit the fundamental principles of competition policy. And I want to start off by referring to the comments in the written submission on the rule of law. And very, very few people know what that means. It's one of those phrases that everyone, if I say, are you for the rule of law, everyone says yes. And if I say, well, what does that mean? Very few people, even professors of law, can give you some sort of coherent answer. What exactly does that mean? So, for example, if I were to say, talk of an area in which we work a lot with informal and small traders. I, for example, am chair of the NAFCOC Parliamentary Committee that deals a lot with the law relating to informal business. The question would be, do the street trading bylaws of Freyet, for example, comply with the rule of law? Now, very few people can actually say yes or no. Very few people understand. So, the purpose of this submission is to really point out to what extent competition policy in particular has actually lost sight of the meaning of the rule of law. Now, there are two important introductory points to make here. The first is the rule of law is the single most important thing in our Constitution. The Constitution is very much like the Bill of Rights or the Communist Manifesto or the Declaration of Independence or one of these famous documents which everyone talks about but very few people have read. Now, Section 1 of our Constitution, which is what's called the Foundational Provisions, provides for, amongst other things, the rule of law. It says everything in South Africa has to be consistent with the rule of law. The Constitutional Court settled that matter in an important case as to whether that is merely a nice phrase, what would be called in law puffery or in marketing, or whether it's a national goal, or whether it's actually binding, what in law is called justiciable. In other words, whether you could take a matter to the Constitutional Court on the grounds that it's inconsistent with the rule of law, and the Constitutional Court said yes. It was then faced with the problem that the rule of law has, over the years, lost a lot of its very clear and unambiguous focus. So let's see what it is. It really consists of three basic ideas. They all are derivatives of the original idea that it's the rule of law as opposed to the rule of man. Now, I don't say that because I'm gender insensitive, Madam Chair. It's because that's the way it was stated. In antiquity, the rule, in other words, where people's rights and obligations are determined by law, not by people, not by discretion. And that's really what it means. Everything else flows from that basic principle. So if you take competition policy, as I'll show, It is no longer that rights and obligations are clearly and unambiguously determined by law, but they are now determined by discretion, namely the opinion of the people in the Competition Commission or Tribunal, rather than clearly identifiable rights and obligations in objective law, which is what the rule of law is about. The second general point about the rule of law is I did mention for the Free Market Foundation the Economic Freedom Index of the World, which you're all welcome to have a copy of. And that is an index of 42 independently published variables in a weighted index that measures economic freedom. One of those variables is called the Rule of Law Index. There is an internationally published Rule of Law Index, and this is very, very important for you and your portfolio committee to really take to heart. The single statistically most significant variable in economic prosperity is not the tax rate or the labor law or the foreign trade policy or the infrastructure spend or anything. It's the rule of law. So in other words, what the world's international experience tells you is if you have a good score on the rule of law index, if you're high on the index, the laws of economics are very generous to you. They'll forgive you for doing other things badly. Conversely, if you do everything else right and you have a bad rule of law score, you'll be in trouble. Your economy will stagnate and contract. The good news is South Africa has a good score on the rule of law index. We're one of the highest scoring countries. So we should be proud of that, and we should really hold on to that. And that probably is a big part of the explanation for some of our success since 94. And people tend to underestimate how successful we have been since 94. Our rule of law index went up and up and up, and we got better and better scores, and that coincided with a really quite well-performing economy. Now, I know that, of course, we have high unemployment, and that's one of the things economists look at, very, very important, and comes at a great human cost. But on most other indices, we've done very well, and I think you as a parliament and lawmakers can pat yourselves on the back for having upheld the rule of law in South Africa. That's the good news. The bad news is that in the last 3 years, our score on the index has slipped. We've been going down. That's very serious and very worrying. One of the reasons we've been going down is because of what I'm about to share with you now regarding competition policy and the extent to which it is in conflict with the rule of law. The first principle of the rule of law, meaning the rule of by law, not by people, is separation of powers. Now, you in your directive for this morning, quite correctly, and I was quite excited to read it, might I say that because of the separation of powers, you have limited function in this issue, which is correct. And I think that that's very, very, very difficult to keep in mind what the rule of law says about separation of powers. To put it very simply, it says that laws must be made by the legislature. The legislature must legislate, and it shouldn't delegate the lawmaking function to the executive. The executive lawmaking function isn't really to make real law, it's actually to make regulations to implement law made here in Parliament. Parliament is the right place to make law, and shouldn't delegate that function to the executive. Secondly, the executive branch of government, the second branch, its job is to execute or implement the law made here. And thirdly, the judiciary, its job is to adjudicate. So the legislature legislates, the executive executes, the judiciary adjudicates. That's where the competition policy seems to have gone off the tracks. What we have here is what essentially is a court, or called in various government documents a quasi-court, a court outside the judiciary. Now, fortunately, it's subject, as it ought to be, to an open-ended right of appeal to the judiciary, that all administrative functions and tribunals should be firstly avoided because they're not capable of functioning as courts, for all sorts of practical and theoretical reasons. For example, they don't have tenure, they're politically appointed, they don't have the infrastructure for precedent, for record keeping, for reports. But secondly, the courts in the executive have the problem that they're politically appointed, whereas in the judiciary you have what's called tenure, which is what the judiciary's got to be independent for, to be able to make rulings freely and willingly, impartially, for or against government, for or against people of different races or genders or ages, but to be impartial. It is very, very difficult, if not impossible, for a tribunal in the executive to be impartial. So this is one of the problems with a thing like the Competition Commission. It has all sorts of consequences. For example, instead of having what are called fines, it has what are called penalties. Well, of course, that's just playing with words. They're in fact fines. So you have something here which doesn't function like a normal court, isn't subject to all the checks and balances of a normal court, isn't applying objective law, and is in fact making retroactive decisions. And that is in breach of the rule of law, the third element of which says you must have legal certainty. Everyone is entitled to know with certainty in advance whether what they're doing is lawful or not. And in the competition law, this is not possible. Now, to display how difficult this is, the South African Chamber of Commerce and Industry, SACI, requested a meeting with the Competition Commission because its members, and it's important to understand, its members are mostly small business, some are big, but mostly small, said they were terrified of the competition law. They had no idea whether what they're doing was lawful. They didn't know whether they would be its next victim. They didn't know when it would strike. People like Sasol, they had seen in the press, had come up with whatever it was, 24 actions that might or might not have been a violation. They weren't sure. Nobody knew, because it's not clear law. It's not objective law. The decision is made arbitrarily, maybe whimsically, retroactively, which is itself in conflict with the rule of law. So, for example, at SACI, where the Competition Commission spoke, it spoke, just to give you an example of how it drives the terror into business people, it said that it hopes that business, the spokesperson said they hope that the business community has learned that what they must do is cooperate. If they resist and they don't immediately cooperate and ask for leniency, they will be fined more heavily. Now, I'm using the word fine because that's what it is. It's not a penalty, it's a fine. In other words, what they were saying was, if you defend yourself, you will be penalized. If you confess, as in some sort of show trial, then you will get off more lightly. So what you must do when accused, you don't know who's accused you. You don't even know really what they've accused you of. You don't know what law you're meant to have broken. If you confess, and I was surprised at the round numbers given, you will be fined 6% of turnover. If you defend yourself, you will be fined 10% of turnover. So I raised the question with the commissioner, and I said, are you saying that we've reached the sad state of affairs in South Africa where defending yourself is an offence? You're going to be fined for doing so. And it was made clear by the commissioner that they can find essentially any business practice to be anti-competitive, which is how vague the law unfortunately is. It was quite interesting that I raised, and which is why I was invited to be there, all sorts of such queries, saying that we don't have certainty, we don't have a proper judiciary, we don't have access to information, we don't have the rights to cross-examination, all the stuff that are taken normally for granted in courts. And then there's this business of defending yourself itself gets penalized. The mere fact that you defend yourself. This is the practice of the Competition Commission. Yeah, this is what they were explaining to the members of the business community. Over lunch and tea, it was quite interesting how people in the audience, big and small, came over to me and they said, thank goodness I was there. because none of them would dare say what I said. They are simply too terrified. Now, this is very, very serious. And I want to urge this committee to actually revisit this law and say, is this really what you want the law to be doing?
Mr. Law, I take this very seriously, yeah. What you are raising now. It's not an allegation.
Yes.
You are saying this is exactly what happened during a particular...
SAGI meeting, yeah.
Yes. Meeting between the Competition Commission and the
business community, who was searching for certainty. Yeah.
Would you mind putting that in writing to us?
With pleasure. It is already in my report, but I'll elaborate for you. With pleasure.
Yes, because I think it should be as you're saying it.
Yes.
And perhaps with exact dates and everything. So
I will with pleasure give you that, because this is, in my view, well. It's important for the Competition Commission, but I really do want to say to you this, that much more fundamentally than the Competition Commission, the competition policy is our country and the rule of law. We really need to get the rule of law properly upheld the way it was after 94, upheld and honored and understood. So people in your committee and in the legislature generally are very clear about what it means. Little or no discretionary power. Let me give you another example outside of the Competition Commission so you get clarity on really what we're talking about here. If you take the taxi recapitalization plan, which is Department of Transport, obviously, you can cut through it all, but in the end what it really says is that government officials will decide which taxi drivers get the recapitalization and get a license. Nobody really knows, but experts estimate that something like 200,000 taxis operate in South Africa and something like 100,000 have a license. That means 100,000 don't have a license. Now the question is, why not? What's different about them? What is the objective test or criterion to make? So what I'm pointing out is that in many, many of our laws, unfortunately, this tendency, which is really one of the worst legacies of apartheid, maybe the worst, is this business of transferring decision-making and law-making to the executive without checks and balances, without guarantees of objectivity, legal certainty, and a full separation of powers. So what this really is an appeal to you is firstly to critically review competition policy and law in the context of the rule of law and the constitution and the separation of powers and such provisions as administrative justice and so on. I can elaborate on those. But secondly, to actually appeal to you to look at this in the broader context of South Africa, which made fantastic gains in and since 94 and seems to be letting it slip. So we really need to recapture the jurisprudential high ground. And that, as I say, is the single statistically most significant variable in the world for prosperity. So if President Zuma says to you, we're going to concentrate on one thing and one thing only this year, what should it be? Your answer ought to be the rule of law. That is the most, more important than any other single thing you can do. Now, as I say, we have a high score now in this country. We are amongst, you know, in the top 20% or so of countries of the world on the index, but we're slipping. And we need to make sure we don't. So that's, I think, essentially it. We would certainly urge you to get our competition policy and law into a state of affairs where everyone knows where they stand, where there's legal certainty, where there's objective criteria, rules of the game. And let me use a sport analogy. If you go onto a sports field, when you go onto the field, you want to know what the rules are. You might disagree with them and you might think there could be better rules, but nonetheless, you can play according to the rules. You want the referee to blow by those rules. In fact, fact, for those of you that follow rugby, one of the things that astonishes me, they talk about the referee's interpretation. And I think they've also lost the plot. It shouldn't be an interpretation. It should be a simple, clear, objective set of rules that if you play by those rules, it's lawful. And if you don't, the whistle blows. And the job of the Competition Commission ought to be the impartial referee blowing the whistle when the rules are broken, and not making rules as it goes, which is unfortunately what's happening now.
Are you done? Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Lowe, once more, as an alien now, not in the previous capacity. Members, you had the presentation. Can we engage with the presentation, please? Babu Ntuli, Babu Mabasa.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Baba. Will you agree with me if I say members of the executive are also members of parliament, except the president? And if you can take us into your confidence, what makes what is new with what we are doing, which we have been doing before, which causes the deterioration of the rule of law or the standard of the rule of law in South Africa? Because members who have been here, we see things as they are being done as before, but according to you, something has changed. If you can take us into your confidence. Thanks.
Thanks, Mabasa.
Now, the only area where I agree very strongly with Mr. Lowe is when he said that the 19 Land Act still needs to be corrected very vigorously. I agree with you. But in the other areas, I want to argue that when you talk and emphasize the rule of law, contained therein is to strive for equity. It's to strive for correcting what is wrong. It's to strive to achieve the level playing field economically and socially. So that if instruments like the commission are devised, and they are devised to be utilized to achieve what I stated, I will argue that that is progressive. And I don't want to believe that the people with whom you had lunch fear us, you know, because I get the impression that you say you are the bravest, so you are the shop steward. But they have been talking here, making inputs, and from the way they have been making inputs, we didn't get the impression that they are fearful of us. Yes, there is mutual respect between us and them, irrespective of views, even if views differ. And I want to assert that the market is not a perfect playing field. Markets are not perfect, and because markets are not perfect, it is therefore necessary for governments to introduce certain measures which would reduce the harm caused by this imperfection. And let me stop by giving an example and say tariffs and you know, such measures, they were not necessarily designed by South Africa or the new democracy. We found those instruments to be instruments that are used worldwide. So I'm saying this so that when the government moves, and remember, this is the government that has been voted for by the majority of South Africans, so they can't have been coerced. Thanks, Colleague Chair.
Thank you, Bob Mabasa. Meso Tetse.
Thank you, Chair. On the issue of companies being penalized for confessing, and to my knowledge, what we read from the papers and reports from the Competition Commission, that these are really big companies, and I think all of them have lawyers. How does it happen that their lawyers cannot detect this flaw that you are referring to? And ever since I was born here in South Africa, I know that in the court of law, you are being persuaded to cooperate, and for that cooperation, you somehow get some leniency. That's why sometimes people, I mean, volunteer to hand themselves over to the police to make their work very simple and not waste resources running around looking for them. It has been effective in South Africa. Thanks.
Thanks, Ms. Otis. Mr. Low, any other? Mr. Low?
Thanks, Madam Chair.
What's your view?
Sorry?
What's your view on the, you spoke of us not needing quasi courts. We have traditional courts that you may also classify under quasi courts. What's your view around our traditional courts?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Starting with the first question, is no, I don't think, Mr. Magusa, that the executive are members of Parliament. On the contrary, the whole idea of the separation of powers is that there should be a very clear separation between them. The only people who straddle that separation are essentially the cabinet, in other words, people who are politicians and in the executive. Ministers.
Can I correct that, Mr. Low? Can I correct it? The only person who's not a member in the executive of parliament is the president. I think you'll agree. Others are all members of parliament before they are members of the executive, except for the constitutional provision of having two members of the cabinet who may be appointed outside parliament by the president. So otherwise, the rest of them are members of parliament.
Oh, sorry, I think there's been my misunderstanding then. I think, to put it very simply, the executive is in Pretoria and the legislature in parliament. People who work for the legislature are in the legislature, as people who work in the judiciary are in the judiciary, whether they're secretaries or clerks or technicians or whatever it might be. So the separation of powers means a firewall between the executive branch of government, which is essentially Pretoria, the legislative branch, which is essentially Cape Town, and the judiciary, which is, of course, all over the country, with the Constitutional Court in Johannesburg and the Appeal Court in Bloemfontein.
The executive have offices in Cape Town, too.
Yes, yes.
Not only in Pretoria. They are also in Cape Town. And I want to stress again that perhaps it's in terms of function.
Well, let me, I can explain this, but...
can I finish? It's a way of, I said earlier that we're going to use these hearings also as a way of educating one another. And that's what has been happening. We've been learning from your side, and it's very important that you also learn from us. That's a way of exchanging, you know, in terms of education. We learn every day. We also are learning from this engagement that we have been today, since Tuesday. Thank you.
Thanks. I think let me just say this, that what's meant by the separation of powers is well-established political science and law, and again, I'm very happy to give you some sort of elaboration on this. There happens to be a very substantial report which will be published soon by the Department of Justice on the principles of good law that goes into these questions of what really are the differences, and we're making a contribution to that. So let me give you a very concrete example some of you may have been involved in, but the Financial Advisory and Intermediary Services Act is an example of a piece of legislation passed here in Parliament that essentially the law itself changed very little. The real law is in 600 pages of regulations which were made outside the legislature under delegated powers. In other words, the legislators, the two people, didn't really make the law. You authorized the executive branch of government to make the law. And there were two senior counsel opinions and two junior counsel opinions, including top people who are regular advisors to the government, David Winterhalter, Gilbert Marcus, for example, who expressed the view that that act for that reason was unconstitutional. And that was handed in to the Finance Portfolio Committee. The point being, the main laws, what's called substantive law, should be made in the legislature, not by the executive in smoke-free rooms. Let's move on to the rule of law and the question of equity. I think it's quite important to understand this. The rule of law is really not concerned with equity in the sense that anything that is equitable is part of the rule of law. The rule of law basically says we don't mind, as jurists, what policy you have, housing policy, land policy, health policy, whatever, but government has to operate according to certain rules. Those rules are the rule of law. That means separation of powers, legal certainty, and general application. In other words, equality at law. Now, that's really all it means, is it doesn't say to the government you should do more about housing or less about the environment or whatever. It simply says whatever you do, you've got to do according to the principles of the rule of law. And then the next question was, what's new? Why has South Africa's score been falling? And it was rising. I have to confess that I don't know the answer to that. In other words, to know that you would have to look at the index itself, components of the index, how they evaluated, the various criteria, the five criteria go into it, and I'm not sure how they scored, but they are, for example, independence of the judiciary, the likelihood of orders being enforced, the certainty of contract, and political interference with the judicial process, and various criteria. It's internationally published, it's on the internet, but I'm perfectly happy to provide you with the detail of what it is that goes into the rule of law index and why we have suddenly started slipping and what must be done to get us back to being really one of the best countries in the world on this point, on this particular feature, which is really a tremendous credit to us and one we should not play lightly with. Should really hold on to very proudly. Then the question of, I didn't say the business community fears you, the business community fears the Competition Commission, and yes, they do have lawyers, and what the Competition Commission said at the SACI meeting is that where the lawyers defended the companies that were under investigation, they ended up paying heavier penalties. In other words, don't defend yourself with however good your lawyers are. And that was certainly how it was interpreted, and when I put it that way, I was not told that it was wrong. Then the question of markets being imperfect, yes, markets are imperfect, and government is imperfect. So just as you get market failure, you get government failure, and what's very important in government is to make sure that you check that your measures are having desired consequences. Now, one of the modern and popular ways of doing this, which you should certainly be encouraged to emulate, is this idea of regulatory impact assessments. The idea being you try to predict in advance what the consequences of policies will be, also unintended consequences, and then you monitor afterwards to see whether you had the desired effect. Now, I want to give you one very concrete example. Is I'm involved with the business community. Some people would say the black business community. Personally, I'm just involved with the business community. And what happens with small business members of NAFCOC, for example, who supported and welcomed the National Credit Act because they're mostly credit receivers and saw it as a means of protecting them, what they didn't anticipate, the unintended consequence, was that the doors have shut. So small businesses, middle and lower income people, essentially can't get credit anymore because it's become too risky, too costly, and too difficult to give credit. So that we are working at the moment within NAFCOC on the question of maybe recommending to government some ways of changing the law because of the devastating impact, unintended impact, on small and independent and medium businesses. For whom credit, well, they're basically the only the credit they now get is in the from loan sharks, not from formal lenders. Conversely, I personally was phoned by my private banker and said, "Mr. Lowe, we see you're underborrowed. Would you like more credit?" And I said, "Yes." In other words, what you're now doing is you're giving credit to people who don't need it, and people who do need it, the doors are shut. So what you want to do is to deal with market imperfection, but also government imperfection is subject to the same challenge. Then the reference was to instruments worldwide. Yes, this is very, very important. We need to learn from the world, and that's what this index does. It looks at the policies all over the world and which policies coincide with desired consequences. In other words, if you want lower crime, higher literacy, better health care, more housing, more jobs, more investment, more savings. What you can do is very, very simple nowadays, very simple software anyone can use. You don't have to be a statistician, and the CD with the software is in each of the books, which you've all been offered. I don't know how many of you took up the offer, but certainly if anyone wants it, let me know. In that, you can see immediately which instruments of policy around the world coincide with success and which coincide with failure. In other words, if you say, what must we do to be more like winners and less like losers, it's actually no longer rocket science. It's now simple. It's a very simple, straightforward answer. What you must do if you want to be a winner from a point of view of policy, which policies to avoid and which to emulate. And then the question was that big companies have been able to represent themselves with the Competition Commission. I do want to make the point that it's often not appreciated how many small companies get involved. It's a case of when the elephants fight, the grass gets trampled. I did mention, for example, the poultry industry, where small independent producers have actually been dealt a very, very severe blow because they can no longer collaborate in order to get cheaper inputs and help market and so on. So what they were doing in order to be competitive has been considered collusive and outlawed. That's actually small businesses, not big businesses, which have been impacted. And there are many examples like that. And then the question that you raised absolutely correctly about leniency and the courts. Yes, the courts do give leniency, but really it's quite important to understand this. Firstly, what was stated here was quite startling, and I don't know if it was misunderstood, but certainly everyone present seems to have understood the same thing, is that if you do not cooperate, meaning if you do not immediately ask for leniency, you will be penalized. Now, a court would never say that. What a court might say is, you can plead for mitigation. You can do a plea bargain, which is very new in South African law, by the way, only since 94. It's an American idea whereby you say, if he and I are both guilty of a theft, and I become the state witness against him, then you let me off. That's the only way the state can get the evidence. And the state then argues this is worth doing, because at least one person gets convicted, one guilty person. But that's a very different thing from saying the fact that you defended yourself is going to be regarded as a reason for increasing the penalty. That our courts would never do. And then the final question from you, Madam Chair, about the traditional courts. Yes, these are something about which I many years ago knew a lot about and used to appear before the traditional courts. They are, as far as I know, they do have what's called tenure, but I don't know enough about them to give you an informed opinion, so I have to pass on that. I do happen to be personally a great supporter of traditional values and communities, and work, for example, with Contralessa and one of your colleagues over here, particularly Anna Misa.
Sir, I've been answered that you're not quite familiar with
it. It's not my turf now.
Yes, thank you very much. But I just want to give you homework here, especially around the initiation of legislation, because this is our terrain. Yeah. We work with it, we know exactly what we're talking about. And this is a constitutional provision. In initiation of legislation by national executive, the national executive may prepare and initiate legislation in terms of section 85(2)(d) of the constitution for introduction in the Such legislation may be introduced in the assembly by a cabinet member or a deputy minister in terms of section 73(2) of the constitution, but only the minister of finance may introduce a money bill. So that meaning that they can introduce any other bill or legislation other than money related legislation. That is something that perhaps you need to look at and empower yourself further on the introduction of legislation in the assembly. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your presentation and your responses. May I then give the opportunity to Mr. Steyn, whom I'm told has arrived. Mr. Steyn is from the Law Review Project. No. Law Society of the Northern Province, yes.
Good afternoon.
Okay, you're welcome.
Honourable Chairperson, members of the committee and Parliament, I'm Peter Steyn from the Law Society of the Northern Provinces, and we welcome this opportunity to make submissions to the committee on the merger control process under our Act. You know, lawyers have a tendency to talk a lot. I like to keep my presentations brief, but the structure will really be to deal with four main topics.
Mr. Steyn, I'm a bit worried that you just arrived. Meaning that you didn't get to hear or an opportunity to hear of our the rule of and conditions of this meeting. Can I then will you give him? Okay. What Mr. Marais is forwarding to you is the condition we are putting here, or the rule for the meeting today. Please make sure that you go through it before you make a presentation. I'll give you just 2 minutes to go through that.
Thank you. Thank you. submissions were made on the basis of excluding references to the merits of the case, etc. Just in summary, what we're going to focus on is firstly the institutional structure of the competition authorities, their jurisdiction and powers, the processes in the Act for assessing mergers, and finally the merger control test. The Act creates three distinct and independent competition authorities, and the independence is enshrined in the Act, and we submit that that is a very important provision of the Act. The first is the Competition Commission, whose powers are primarily investigatory, although they do decide intermediate mergers. The Competition Tribunal is an independent adjudicative tribunal. It's not a court, it's an administrative tribunal, which decides large mergers, as well as appeals against the Commission's decisions. The members of the tribunal are appointed by the President on recommendation of the Minister of Economic Development from persons nominated by the Minister or pursuant to public call nominations. The tribunal members are required by the Act to have suitable experience in economics, law, commerce, industry, and or public affairs, and also to represent a broad cross-section of the South African population. The Competition Appeal Court, which is the third competition body, is a division of the High Court of South Africa. And we believe the structure is very effective in that it links into the High Court system. And the Competition Appeal Court is a specialized division of the High Court, which decides appeals against decisions of the tribunal. And in certain cases, the decisions of the Appeal Court may be appealed to the Supreme Court of Appeal, or with regard to constitutional issues, the Constitutional Court. We submit that key features of the competition authorities created by the Act are firstly their independence. We believe this gives their decisions credibility and also allows an impartial and objective assessment of mergers by the competition authorities. The second key feature is the checks and balances within the structure. By having three separate authorities, you bring a balancing of powers between the commission, the tribunal, as well as the appeal court. The process of appeals allows decisions to be reviewed and checked. We believe these checks and balances promote independence, administrative justice, and fairness. And finally, another key feature is their specialist nature. We believe this is a key benefit to the structure of the authorities under the Act, because competition law enforcement is highly specialized and involves both law and economics. And this is also in line with international trends where you have specialized competition authorities. We believe the creation of specialist authorities considerably enhances the effectiveness of enforcing the Act and competition policy, and also allows the development of specialist knowledge, skills, and experience within the authority. And this specialization has contributed to the significant and successful development of South African competition law since the Act came into force in 1999. Before 1999, the Act with competition authorities were really mainly investigative, they had very few decision-making powers. In 1999, the key reform of the Act was to give real decision-making powers to the competition authorities, and we support that development. In a nutshell, the Law Society supports the current structure of the competition authorities and believes it has contributed to the successful, credible, and effective enforcement of the Act since 1999. We believe the structure has proven to be a robust, it has stood the test of time for the last 11 years, and draws an adequate balance between the need to protect consumers, strengthen the economy, and provide legal and procedural certainty to all stakeholders involved in the process. The next topic will deal with the jurisdiction and powers of the competition authorities. And firstly, the Act expressly provides that the Act applies to all economic activity within or having an effect within South Africa. That is a very important distinction because it allows conduct outside South Africa to be considered to the extent that it has an effect in South Africa. And the Law Society supports this approach because it excludes irrelevant matters and also ensures the most appropriate use of the staff and resources of the competition authorities. The merger control test itself, in summary, deals with the effect of a merger on both competition in South Africa as well as four public interest factors set out in the Act. It is important to note that the powers of the competition authorities are created by the Act and are limited by the Act. And their powers to assess a merger with regard to matters falling outside the scope of the merger control test would be unlawful. It is important that the Act itself provides a framework for the competition authorities to exercise their mandate. The Law Society submits that it is not the role of the competition authorities to make, regulate, or implement other industrial and economic policies which fall under the jurisdiction of other government departments or regulators. Furthermore, we submit that having specialist competition authorities with broad investigative powers is a key benefit of the Act. So when I said earlier that the Act limits their powers, that's correct, but they also confer significant powers on the authorities to effectively enforce their mandate. The specialist nature of the competition authorities and would be the benefits of that would be lost or were diluted at best if the competition authorities were required to focus on other fields. We believe that having a specialist authority dealing with competition policy is very important, and that if the competition authority's mandate was expanded to non-competition fields, this would result in a diversion of staff and resources, which would dilute the mandate to enforce competition policy. In summary, the Law Society considers that the jurisdiction and powers of the competition authorities under the Act are both appropriate and effective, and that they need not be reconsidered. The next topic is the merger control process in the Act. And just in brief summary, the first stage of any merger control process is an investigation by the Commission. And the Law Society again submits that this is appropriate given the specialist power, skills and expertise as well as the investigatory powers of the Commission. The Law Society submits that since its formation in 1999, the Commission has established a track record as a reputable, transparent, and effective regulator. And this has been recognized internationally, including by Global Competition Review, which this year awarded our Commission the Agency of the Year in Asia Pacific, Middle East, and Africa Award. The Commission has also been active in establishing the African Competition Forum, which is an organization of African competition regulators. The second phase of the merger control adjudication process is the tribunal investigation and hearing, the public hearing. And again, the Law Society submits that the tribunal has since 1999 established itself as a transparent and effective adjudicator in competition matters and is held in high regard both internationally and locally. Both the Commission and the Tribunal play an important role in the International Competition Network, which is an international organization of competition regulators. And in 2011, the World Economic Forum Annual Global Competitiveness Report ranked South Africa's authority 12th out of 139 countries on the extent to which anti-monopoly policy promotes competition. Another key feature of the Act is the participation in the merger control process of all relevant stakeholders, including trade unions, employee representatives, and the Minister of Economic Development, as well as other ministers, and third parties like competitors, customers, and other stakeholders with a recognized material interest in the merger. Each merger must be notified to the Minister of Economic Development, and he has the right to participate fully in the merger control process on public interest grounds. All participating stakeholders are entitled under the Act to make representations, lead evidence, cross-examine witnesses, and submit documents to the tribunal. And this allows for all relevant views on a merger to be fully aired and scrutinized in a public forum. The Law Society supports this process because it allows the tribunal to make a fully informed decision after hearing all interested stakeholders. The tribunal's decision itself is made after considering evidence on a balance of probabilities. That's the evidence laid before it at the public hearing, and gives written decisions for its decisions. Written reasons for its decisions, excuse me. The fact of giving written decisions promotes transparency, which is very important, and has also contributed significantly to the development of our competition law since 1999. And these judgments have generally been held in high regard, both locally and internationally. The tribunal may impose conditions on its approval of a merger, and in practice such conditions may be volunteered by the merging parties or may be negotiated and agreed with the Commission before being submitted to the tribunal for decision. believe this provides an important flexibility in addressing any concerns a merger may raise. The tribunal's decisions, as stated earlier, are also subject to appeal, which allows the decisions to be tested by another body. So in other words, the tribunal has not got the final say. And this provides for checks and balances of the tribunal's powers, and again promotes independence, administrative justice, fairness, and transparency. The Law Society submits that the merger control process in the Act promotes a transparent, fair, and effective assessment of mergers, and that the competition authorities have, since their formation in 1999, established themselves as reputable, transparent, and effective regulators. The last point deals with the merger control test under the Act. And unlike most foreign countries, the merger control test in the Act is not limited to assessing the effect of the merger on competition, but also covers four public interest grounds, namely the effect of the merger on a particular industrial sector or region, the effect on employment, the effect on the ability of small businesses or firms controlled or owned by historically disadvantaged persons to become competitive, and then lastly, the effect on the ability of national industries to compete in international markets. The Law Society submits that the inclusion of public interest grounds, notwithstanding that it's not common outside South Africa, we believe it is appropriate for South Africa, given our history and our state of development. We also submit that the wording in the Act is wide enough to cover the purposes set out in the Act. And the purposes of, I'll just read from the Act if I may. To promote the efficiency, adaptability, and development of the economy. To provide consumers with competitive prices and product choices. 3, to promote employment and advance the social and economic welfare of South Africans. 4, to expand opportunities for South African participation in world markets and recognize the role of foreign competition in South Africa. To ensure that small and medium-sized enterprises have an equitable opportunity to participate in the economy and to promote a greater spread of ownership. We believe that the wording of the public interest grounds in Section 2 of the Act are in line with these purposes and also enable a wider investigation and assessment of the effects of the merger in South Africa. However, we do submit that if a merger does not have an anti-competitive effect, then it would be exceptional to prohibit that type of merger on the basis of a public interest concern, because it seems unlikely, highly unlikely, that the public interest concern could not be addressed by a condition imposed by the tribunal. The tribunal, again, as being a specialist body, is best placed after hearing all stakeholders in a public hearing to consider both whether a condition is required as well as the economic effects of the condition within the specific context of the merger. An inherent difficulty of the merger control process is that it assesses the possible future effects of a merger. Any assessment of a merger involves considering the probabilities that a competition or public interest concern will in fact arise after the merger is implemented. So, unfortunately, it implies that one has to make an assessment of what the future effects of the merger would be. And again, the need for having specialist bodies to investigate and decide mergers is critical. In addition, the necessary checks and balances between those bodies permits a thorough assessment of the merger's effect or likely effect. The Law Society submits that the merger control process has been applied by the competition authorities in a clear, consistent, and certain manner, and that this has again contributed to the successful development of our competition law since 1999. We submit that the same rules must apply to all merging parties, whether they are local or foreign, and if conditions are imposed, those conditions must be specifically linked to and arise from the particular merger. The Law Society submits that the current merger control test in the Act is appropriate for South Africa and has been effectively applied in practice in the last 11 years and need not be reconsidered. In conclusion, the Act itself was the product of a thorough policy review and extensive negotiations between all stakeholders, including government, trade unions, and business. And as submitted previously, the Act has established an appropriate and effective framework for investigating and assessing the economic aspect of mergers, including public interest issues. submit that the merger control regime currently functions well in practice and also allows full stakeholder participation in a public forum. And we submit in conclusion that there is no need for the current merger control regime to be reconsidered. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Steyn, for the submission. Can we then hear from members what they're saying about this? Okay. Mr. Mare.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much for the submission. It was quite neutral and quite on the subject. So thank you very much for that. You have quite clearly indicated that the competition authorities are doing a great job. So there's quite clear confidence in their ability and what they do and how they've done it so far. And the fact that they have added, their work has added to the global competitive ranking of 12 out of 139 countries. Are you confident that the authorities, both the Commission and the Tribunal, have applied their mind properly in all cases in terms of their findings, including the Walmart merger? That's the first one. Second one is, would a challenge by government on the findings of the Tribunal impact in any way on their reputation and their independence, even if it's just a perception of an intrusion on their independence? And would that impact in any way on our global competitiveness rating? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Mara. Dr. Mabas.
Thank you very much, Comrade Chair. Well, thanks for the input. My question, I want to concur with the input in as far as the broad policies are outlined and in as far as their objectives are concerned. But the question that I want to ask is that I want to assume that when it comes to application is a very variable factor, you know, and it is a subjective in a way. It challenges us on subjective grounds. So I want to ask, going more now into application, to say when a merger happens between two huge companies such that we end up with what we could call a monopoly, is that not a recipe for the small existing companies in the country, in the hosting country, to be trampled upon and destroyed by this huge giant, especially when we get to areas like employment, because where a monopoly unleashes its power, typically it may do so with an objective of killing the other competitors, even if it starts off with a loss. It can afford to endure the loss because it knows it will make up for that loss from its other companies, you know, internationally. So, coming to our situation, and we are a developed developing country where we need more business players than few. So that instead of a measure, one will even be thinking that businesses should be doing the opposite so that we have a more healthy competition. So what will be your comment there? Because the consequences of the case I'm building is that the small businesses may be forced to close down. I'm referring here to businesses like in the townships, rural areas, you know. And as they close down, they are closing down because of the prices that have exceptionally been lowered by the invading company, I mean the monopoly company. And immediately after they have closed down, they have been killed, then the true colors of the monopoly company may be seen, where it will then raise prices and there won't be competing companies to the detriment of both consumers and workers. I'm inviting comments in those areas. Thanks, Colin Chen.
Thanks, Bob Mabasa. Okay. Are you a lawyer?
Yes, I am.
Are you a competition lawyer?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Wanted to be sure. Are there... Why? Because we've heard since Tuesday that there are people who are not really represented. Are you able to represent anybody coming from any level of, whether it's small, medium, or big enterprise? And in your view, are the lower levels that would be the imagine, the small and medium enterprises, would you say they are well represented in terms of the issues that concern them at that level of business?
Thank you.
Okay.
With regard to your question, I think I'll deal with first. I think the representation of small and medium-sized business or consumers by lawyers is an issue I can't really comment on, in the sense that I think one of the issues one understands is access to justice. But with regard to the Competition Act itself, I think it's important to note that the Commission, anyone can lay a complaint with the Commission, any consumer, any small business, any medium-sized business. And the Commission can then take that complaint and investigate it.
They can do so only if they are aware of their rights and if they know they are aware of the existence of the Competition Commission. And you know, if they are educated enough, would you agree with me?
I agree, absolutely. And
but why does it seem like many people, especially even the consumers themselves, are complaining that they don't have, even if they can have a know-how, but the knowledge of, but they fear that upon appearing there, they feel jittery because when they get there, they are more powerful people with very, high-powered legal representation than they are. Would you want to comment around that?
I think the Commission does play an advocacy role. And I think the successes of the Commission, particularly with regard to the cartel cases, has publicized its achievements in the Act and the protections in the Act for consumers. But I think the key thing is maybe more competition, more advocacy, not just by the Commission, but by the other bodies, legal fraternity, business fraternity.
As a law society, your role in that regard, I know what the Competition Commission is doing, but I was asking in relation to your work as the law society of the Northern Provinces.
I think one of the issues is that competition law is quite a specialist field, but the law society does have a committee specializing on competition law, which involves anyone who's interested in competition law. And I think the challenge maybe for all stakeholders in the competition process is to increase advocacy and training. I believe that younger lawyers are more and more interested Yeah, I think it really starts at the universities, the way competition law is taught at the universities, to emphasize that young law students and young lawyers see it as a very exciting field and a very important field, and one in which they can base a career. I think the first question was whether we were satisfied that the competition authorities apply their mind in every case. I think, you know, there's often, law is often a lot of grey, and it often leads to interpretations. But I think what the Law Society can submit is that the competition law process and the competition authorities have been transparent, effective, and in a sense, where cases have gone against a particular lawyer or against a particular client, those reasons have been in writing by the tribunal, have been subject to appeal, have been subject to being tested by the appeal court where necessary or where deemed fit. And I think the process itself, because it has its checks and balances, allows for the grey area to be clarified. When you bring in new legislation, as we did in 99, it's almost every case is almost trying to set a precedent. What we have achieved in the last 11 years with the competition authorities and competition lawyers is create a framework where there's greater certainty as to what the boundaries of the Act are. I mean, there's some cases are simple. I mean, fixing prices between competitors, that can't be justified. I think the key grey areas often come in when you say something is prohibited because it has an anti-competitive effect, and that is where the grey comes in. But I think the process established by the Act and the way the Commission and the Tribunal, as well as the Appeal Court, have applied the Act has certainly created a very transparent and effective competition framework. And certainly we're a lot further down the road than we were in 99. The next question was whether the challenge by government would impact on the independence and effectiveness of the competition authorities. I think the point needs to be made that any challenge by government has got to be within the framework of the Act and the law. So to the extent that the government is entitled in law to challenge or review a decision of the competition authorities. And it's important to note that the Minister of Economic Development is entitled under the Act to participate in both an appeal process as well as the merger process from inception. So the Act allows the government, or in this case particularly the Minister of Economic Development, to be involved in the process. So to the extent if the government exercises its rights under the Act, I think the key question is if the decision goes against it, the Competition Appeal Court or the Constitutional Court or the Supreme Court of Appeal does not agree with the government's case, then you know, the test will be the government is bound by the decision of the courts. So I don't think that the mere fact that the government or the minister in this case challenges or does not agree with the decision of the competition authority undermines the system. I think then lastly, I think your point was if a merger, and the key thing, starting point to your question was if a merger results in a monopoly, I think just stopping there, if a merger will result in a monopoly, then that's a serious consideration as to whether that monopoly is, whether the merger is anti-competitive, whether the merger raises serious competition concerns. I mean, if for example, there are only two competitors in a market, and one competitor buys the other, on the face of it, that merger raises serious concerns from a competition perspective, not even going towards the public interest test. So the question would be, the creation of a monopoly, can that be justified, or should the merger be prohibited just because it has an anti-competitive effect? Now, if it was approved, in the sense of the merger did result in a very powerful creation of a powerful firm, and certainly in some foreign jurisdictions, the competition authorities have this concept of creating national champions, so creating big local firms who can compete internationally. In South Africa, we don't have that approach. But assuming that a merger did result in the creation of a powerful firm, I think it's important to note that the merger control provisions of the Act are only part of the Act. The other provisions are very important, particularly with regard to the conduct of powerful dominant firms. Dominant firms, for example, cannot
indulge in predatory price wars, where they lower the price to try to force out their competitors. It's what's known as abuses of dominance within the Act. Exclusionary acts, telling a customer or supplier they can't deal with a competitor. So the point I'm making is that if a merger did create a powerful firm, it doesn't mean the powerful firm can act as it likes. Within the Competition Act, there are various prohibitions on conduct and regulations on conduct of dominant firms, as well as non-dominant firms, for example, price fixing, cartel conduct, vertical restrictive practice, minimum resale price maintenance being one of them. So my answer to your question would be that, firstly, the creation of a monopoly or a dominant firm would probably raise serious competition concerns. And if it was allowed, there would probably have to be some sort of conditions. I doubt if the competition authorities would easily just allow the creation of a monopoly, in other words, 100% firm or even a very powerful dominant firm. They would take into account the fact of the level of competition in a market. So, if the merger did result in the creation of a powerful firm, there is a framework within the Act to regulate the conduct of powerful firms in the market. And the purpose of the Act being to promote the competition process. I mean, one of the issues which is often a bit of a mantra in competition law is that the competition laws are there to protect the competitive process and not individual competitors. In other words, just because a particular competitor can't compete in a fair market, in other words, fair competition, does not mean that the merger is necessarily anti-competitive. The key thing is to have a level playing field. That is why the Act provides special restrictions on the conduct of powerful dominant firms.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stein. For the responses, I have one more question from Mem Zodesi, but before she comes in, I'd like to welcome the school from Limpopo. I understand it's a primary school from Venda. Limpopo, you're welcome. I can't speak Venda. Can you welcome them? Yes.
Where's the name?
A very warm welcome. It shows that South Africa is shrinking every day, and as the world shrinks. Ndimasiya ri avudi ri avivua nga usuka havo vachida hafa parliament. But because your ages tell me that you are probably at high school, then
private,
okay, no. Then I did the right thing by emphasizing both languages. But let me end by saying education, education, and education, like Tata Mandela says.
Thank you, Mr. Mabasa. Meso Tetsi.
Thank you, Chair. I need clarity on paragraph 3.2 in page 3. You know, one is disadvantage of the fact that one is a layperson in the legal field and English being another language. But what does it actually imply in as far as this matter is concerned? That is the Competition Commission in the right track or they overstep their jurisdiction?
Over to Mr. Stein.
Thank you. The competition authorities are a creation of the Act. Their powers are in the Act. So if they go beyond their powers, they're doing something which the Act does not authorize them to do.
What's the implication in relation to the matter that you are referring to?
The implication of which point? 3.2 on the jurisdictions and powers of the competition authority.
Excuse me.
Can you elaborate a bit on that? Yeah. I think that's why it's a bit concerned.
Good.
Can you elaborate on the question?
I'm trying to clarify myself as to whether it is
point we were trying to make was that the merger control test says that the tribunal must assess the effect of the merger on competition and then on four public interest grounds. So in other words, the tribunal hasn't got the power to assess the merger on anything outside that, the test, what the test says. So in other words, for example, it cannot make a decision which is the decision of another regulator, like ICASA. So its jurisdiction, its powers are limited to assessing the merger's effect on the competition, as well as the four public interest grounds set out in the Act. It cannot make a decision or test the merger on something which is not related to that merger control test.
Okay, understandable. Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Steyn, for your appearance to this hearing. We really appreciate your submission. Thank you. Can we have a 5 minutes break? Just grab tea and come back if you can. Then those who want to stretch. Just a comfort break. 5 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you.
presenter for today is the Economic Development Department. And that will be, they will be led by the DG. Babe Slevo. Babe Levine.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members, colleagues, members of the media, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Thank you very much to the committee for giving us this opportunity. If I could indicate at the outset that this is an interdepartmental presentation of economic development, agriculture, forestry and fisheries, and the Department of Trade and Industry. And that I'm joined by a number of colleagues, Dr. Duncan Hindle, the Special Advisor to the Minister of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, Mr. Joseph Cibola, who is from the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, Mr. Garth Strachan, Department of Trade and Industry, as well as Ms. Swazi Taitai, Mr. Robert Shaw, Ms. Stepane Mohale, and Ms. Zubeda Jaffa of the Economic Development Department. Thank you again for this opportunity, which we appreciate very much. And just to indicate up front that in line with the directive issued by the committee, we will endeavor to avoid reference to issues subject to judicial decision in our presentation. We will not comment on the Competition Tribunal's decision and reasons. These, as we know, are matters of public record in any event. But our key task here today is to focus on the impact of the merger and mergers in general, and the impact that they have on employment, industrial development, local manufacturing, and economic development. So that is our key remit in our understanding, is that we need to look at the impact. And obviously, in terms of our involvement and the manner in which we are able to intervene as departments of government and the ministers concerned is through the instruments provided to us by the legislation. And that's the point of departure, is to look at the relevant aspects of the Competition Act and initially to look at the developmental aims of competition legislation to promote the adaptability and development of the economy, to promote employment and advance the social and economic welfare of South Africans, to ensure that small and medium-sized enterprises have an equitable opportunity to participate in the economy, to promote a great spread of ownership, in particular to increase the ownership stakes of historically disadvantaged persons. So these particular dimensions of the legislation shape the manner in which we would respond as government to particular matters which impact on competition within the economy. Now, over and above those broad developmental goals, there are specific aspects of the legislation which would guide us insofar as we would involve ourselves in particular actions which take place in the marketplace. The first important and the fundamental important issue here is the issue of public interest, which the Act specifically provides for, even where competition will not be negatively affected. And the Act specifies that the Competition Commission and or the Competition Tribunal must consider the effect of the merger on a particular industrial sector or region, employment, the ability of small businesses or firms controlled or owned by historically disadvantaged persons to become competitive, and the ability of national industries to compete in international markets. So these are the parameters of the public interest issues which are of grave concern to government. Specifically, in Section 18(1) of the Act, the Minister of Economic Development is empowered to intervene in any merger to protect the public interest. My esteemed colleague from the South African Law Society who preceded us made it very clear that these are the parameters of the legislation within which it would be expected that the minister intervenes in order to consider these matters which may have an impact on the public interest. Now, in addition to legislation, government policy also guides government when dealing with matters of competition. And the issue of employment is absolutely fundamental to government's considerations. It's also a matter, as we know from having looked at the relevant sections of the legislation, that the tribunal is obliged to consider in determining whether a merger can be justified on public interest grounds. Now, government's focus on employment matters is informed by the unemployment situation which we have in the country. South Africa is ranked among the 10 countries with the lowest level of employment in the world. Fewer than half of the working age population of South Africans are in income-generating employment. We have an official unemployment rate of 25%. And in terms of the latest findings of the Quarterly Labour Force Survey of Stats South Africa, 40% of our population aged between 16 and 30 are unemployed. Now, it is obligatory upon government, both the executive and the administrative apparatus of the state, with due respect to esteemed Mr. Leon Lowe, are not one and the same things. The administrative apparatus of the state, the public service and public administration, is obliged to translate the electoral mandate of any ruling party into concrete implementable programs and to apply its collective mind and actions to the implementation of the electoral mandate of any ruling party of the day. Now, we know that employment creation is one of the five key priorities of the ruling party. And in line with that priority, Cabinet adopted a new growth path in October 2010 with its primary focus on employment creation. The new growth path identifies the sectors with high employment potential and interventions to maximize this potential. It identifies the macro and micro interventions to create an enabling environment for employment creation, including, by the way, competition policy as a micro economic intervention. And it is important to say that the new growth path has received widespread support from social partners. We are currently involved in a national process of social dialogue through which two accords on skills and basic education have already been signed by all the social partners participating at the NEDLAC level. Moreover, the Industrial Policy Action Plan, IPAP 2 of government, also has employment creation taxation as one of its primary considerations, whereby it seeks to strengthen the productive sectors of the economy and promote local procurement. It identifies key manufacturing sectors that government will support. And IPAC 2, like the New Growth Path, has received widespread support from social partners. There are also fundamental food security concerns within the overall ambit of government policy and action, which rarely center on the issue of value chains. If these disintegrate, agriculture, agro-processing, and food production may become unviable. Moreover, the South African economy will become more vulnerable to international price and currency fluctuations and more affected by international food shortages should these value chains disintegrate. Now, there is a basic chronology, and we will not delve into the detail in order to stay within our basic remit pertaining to the merger. These were the key milestones: the notification in November 2010, the recommendation by the Commission on the 11th of February, the interventions by the departments on the 24th, 25th of February, March 22 to 25, the hearings on the merger and the discovery hearings, and then 9 to 16 May 2011, the hearings on the actual merger. Let me say that the department, our department, Economic Development Department, did in February initiate dialogue with the merger parties as well as Labour. And we also engaged the merger parties with the aim of concretizing their commitments around procurement, which we felt were rather vague. It's also important to say that in finalizing its recommendations, the Competition Commission assumed that the discussions and the dialogue taking place between the merger parties and the unions as facilitated by economic development would result in undertakings that would be captured in the tribunal order. So that assumption was part of the Commission's recommendations that the merger should take place without conditions. Now, this did not materialize, and it's on that basis, the fact that we did not get the kind of undertakings that we sought, that the intervention of the departments within the Competition Tribunal hearings took place fully within the parameters of the law, which I referred to at the beginning of this presentation. It's also important to say that as a result of government's intervention, the merger parties did make undertakings which were ultimately captured in the tribunal order. Now, why did government intervene? What was the rationale? There is a public record of what took place in the tribunal, and I refer now strictly to the heads of argument.
Then to the impact, I think
some of the areas around the impact that might not require that you mention, especially where they dwell on the merit of the case, of the appeal that you have put before the court. Yeah, and that would relate to when I look at one under the impact, and when I look at three, that might have the undesirable effect on the case. I don't know whether you understand what I mean. This is what we meant when we said we do not need to get into the merits of the case, because they might undermine what you have put before the authorities. Otherwise, you may continue.
Okay, in the light of your ruling, Chairperson, I would then need to pass over the slides dealing with the rationale, the Walmart facts, and the impact of this merger. Those slides really refer to the scale of the company, which we are talking about, and begins to talk of some of the potential impacts which a merger of a company of this size would have on matters pertaining to employment, local supply industries, local manufacturing, and local procurement. Perhaps then I should move to the myths, because there are certain assumptions that have been attached to government's actions and intervention which it would be important to dispel through these hearings. The first of these would be that South Africa is adopting a protectionist stance. This is something that has been read into government's intervention. But it is important to emphasize that South Africa does have an open trade regime with lower aggregate tariffs than many other developing countries. It's also important to emphasize that South African trade policy is aligned with its industrial policy, and that a judicious and selective use of a variety of policy instruments supports local employment. Of course, there are broader debates which have surfaced, I would think, in some respects, and certainly in terms of the hearings this afternoon, around the whole concept and practice of free trade, both domestically, regionally, and globally. But certainly it would be a myth to argue that because of this intervention, South Africa is merely demonstrating a protectionist stance. The second important myth is that the merger is about foreign direct investment. And by logical inference, therefore, government's actions are a commentary or an indication of its stance towards foreign direct investment. The basic point to make is that Massmart, the local company, merging with Walmart, is 72% foreign owned. The key issue here is not about foreign direct investment. The key issue is about a particular merger. That is what the issue is. There's unlikely through this merger to be a change in the level of foreign ownership. But also, let's emphasize that South Africa does seek foreign direct investment. It seeks foreign direct investment that will help us to rebuild the productive sectors of the economy. That is where we as a country and a nation seek foreign direct investment. Let us also say that if the impact was on the same scale as a Walmart Massmart type merger, government stance towards a merger between local companies would have been the same. So that's the second myth we would like to dispel. And in relation to this is a myth which says that other countries are much more open to foreign direct investment. Let's take Canada as an example. The Investment Canada Act makes provision for a net benefit assessment for foreign direct investment. And what is assessed is firstly the effect on the level of economic activity in Canada, on employment, on resource processing, on the utilization of parts and services produced in Canada, and on exports from Canada. Secondly, the degree and significance of participation by Canadians in the Canadian business or new Canadian business and in any industry or industries in Canada. Thirdly, the effect of the investment on productivity, industrial efficiency, technological development, product innovation, and product variety in Canada. Fourthly, the effect of the investment on competition within any industry in Canada. Fifthly, the compatibility of the investment with national industrial, economic, and cultural policies. And finally, the contribution of the investment to Canada's ability to compete in world markets. Now, obviously, if we look at these criteria inherent in the legislation in Canada, and we compare to the policy and legislative framework that I have sketched out, we see that we are very much on par and in line with the kind of requirements we would find in many countries across the globe, and we've used the Canadian example. And if we look further, these provisions were used recently in Canada to block an investment, the BHP Billiton bid for potash, in which the Minister of Industry found that the company had not satisfied the requirement that the investment would create a net benefit for Canada. Now, I'm going to still make a point around this, but it's a very important point, because I have heard some of my esteemed colleagues who preceded me in these hearings referring to issues around separation, the independence of the Competition Commission, etc., etc. And obviously, I'm not going to pass opinion on whether any of these separations are in any way being undermined, because I feel confident that they are not. But the important point here is that in the Canadian context, it is the executive which directly makes these kinds of decisions. So notwithstanding slippages or whatever we score on some international league table of transparency, our system is actually more transparent than that of an esteemed country in the world order of rankings of various sort, such as Canada. Now, the next myth is that government seeks to protect monopolies or inefficiency. I think it's important for us to say that the general retail market in South Africa is already highly competitive in many different ways. The next myth is...
Can I buy from talking to the next myth as it relates to the conditions?
Okay. The following myth then, government seeks to disadvantage poorer consumers. Basically, what we can say in this regard is that what we are endeavoring to do in South Africa is to ensure that we create employment. Employment creation stands at the center and heart of our economic development strategies, and that what we want to ensure is that we solve our key developmental challenge of unemployment so that poor people in this country obtain money, assets, and resources through access to employment. We also would like to point out that our consumption sectors are growing at twice the rate of our productive sectors, and that this is absolutely unsustainable. It is imperative that we focus on our productive sectors in order to enhance employment creation and not our consumption sectors. Now, coming back to the points that I was making with respect to Canadian legislation on foreign direct investment, there is a myth that government's approach is out of line with the rest of the world. Now, the first point is to make that anywhere in the world, governments act on a public mandate which is given by citizens during election campaigns. That is part and parcel of democracy. Political parties go out and compete, and the party that emerges as the ruling party comes with a particular mandate from the citizens that have voted into power. And acting within that mandate cannot be anything which is extraordinary when we look at democratic practice globally. The second point is the one that I was referring to, and that is that in other jurisdictions, transactions are prohibited or conditions are imposed upon them by the executive authority. In this case, they're not, because it is the competition authorities, independent organs of the state, that will make these determinations. In Canada, it would be an executive authority. In Australia, it would be an executive authority that would make these rulings. We are not attempting to make these rulings at all. The executive nor the administrative apparatuses are attempting to make these rulings. Within the rules of the game, as prescribed by the legislation, we are participating according to those rules. With particular positions we deem to be critical in the light of our overriding priority, which is the creation of jobs. In the United States, some public authorities have prohibited Walmart from operating in their areas. The example here is New York. Or they have imposed conditions on their entry into the market. Moreover, in the case of Germany, the German Supreme Court found that Walmart Germany was guilty of illegal predatory pricing of certain products. In conclusion, then, Madam Chair, honorable members, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, members of the media, government is seeking to protect the public interest by ensuring that the merger does not undermine employment, industrial development, small business, and firms controlled by historically disadvantaged individuals. Because of government's participation in the tribunal, proceedings were highly relevant. Sorry, because of the participation in the tribunal hearings, information that was highly relevant but insufficient about the effect of the transaction on local procurement and employment in South Africa was made available by the merging parties. Through this process, government has demonstrated that there is a substantial public interest concern in this merger. We do believe that there is evidence in the possession of the merging parties that would confirm the extent of the negative impact of the merger. We have therefore now applied to review the tribunal's decision on the merger and the process it adopted in the merger hearing. We believe it is absolutely essential that the public interest concerns are properly ventilated in the tribunal proceedings after the merging parties have made adequate discovery of information and relevant witnesses have had sufficient time to make oral submissions. Finally, I would like to emphasize that government does support a transparent, independent and expeditious merger review process in which all key stakeholders, including government, can engage meaningfully in order to ensure outcomes which are pro-competitive and in the public interest. Thank you very much, Chairperson. There is just one point that I would like to note, and perhaps the colleagues from Agriculture would like to elaborate, and that is with respect to the impact of mergers on agriculture. We have circulated a document which we hope would become part of the record of these proceedings. I'm not sure if my colleagues would like to add anything beyond that.
Did you? I think you have exceeded the time allocated with 5 minutes. If maybe Dr. Duncan can allow members to ask questions, then in the process of responding, perhaps you can then come in. Thank you very much for the presentation from government. And let me now give the opportunity to members to ask questions of clarity and comments where possible. Member Marais, Member Mabasa. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you, DG. Just on the one myth that you have mentioned, the mergers about foreign direct investment. Obviously, FDIs is not only needed for productive sectors, there's other reasons for FDIs as well, like our increasing deficit on the balance of payments. So it's also very important. Just on that, I read the other day in the paper this week about the acquisition of the Wisiswe Platinum by Jingxuan from China, 45%, and where they've reported that the local beneficiation will be moved to China. In terms of that is very close to a merger or is at least an acquisition, how would you respond to that in terms of at least public interest? At least it's a clear indication that job losses will be imminent there, quite clearly. Then secondly, about the competition authorities, can you maybe just acknowledge, you know, whether you acknowledge or respond, whether you acknowledge the independence of the Competition Commission and the Tribunal, and obviously by that, you know, accepting their rule and their findings. Also, whether you've got faith and trust in these two parties, in their abilities, in the impartiality, in their structure. Then also, can you give us how many cases did the government or the minister appealed against tribunal findings in the past? And then lastly, do you believe that government should have a veto power or a vote on any findings of the Competition Commission and Tribunal, and if so, under what conditions and what circumstances, do you think that in that circumstances that ministers should be able to interpret the law and the policy for specific cases? And lastly, in that, which is part of that same point, do you believe that we need to amend the Competition Act? And if so, can you give an indication? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mr. Mara. Mabasa.
Thanks. Thanks, Comrade Chair, and also thanks, Siyabonga, Rabu DG. I want to ask that, am I making the right assumption if I say huge monopolies internationally, if unchecked by governments of course acting in the public interest, usually have the weaknesses of swallowing whether it is called measures, whether whatever it is called, such that that process reduces competition. It's not necessarily increasing competition. And that sometimes such monopolies enter a country under the guise of acting in the public interest. But part of the critical component of public interest is salaries earned by people in the country, because even if prices are lowered, but if unemployment is so huge that people cannot buy the so-called cheap goods, I observe that that is counterproductive. It's not in the interest of the hosting country. And when it comes to small business, huge monopolies sometimes enter areas that used to be run by small business people, a daily shop at the corner, fish and chips at the other corner. But when huge monopolies enter, they tend to swallow up such, and it then kills the domestic small industry under the guise of lowering prices. But as soon as those are dead, typically monopolies will then increase their prices, no longer fearing any competition, and they can sometimes argue, or they can sometimes go for a period, a remarkable period, with lowered prices, knowing that they are making gains or profits from other countries in the meantime. Then my last one, but last, is that in a developing country like South Africa, which where some of the characteristics are inequalities, racial mainly, poverty and joblessness, will I be making the right comment if I say policies must be such that they narrow the gap between the haves and the have-nots, and they reduce poverty, and they create jobs. But my last point is that the fact that the minister can review transparently decisions made by the tribunal is that, am I making the right observation if I say that speaks well to inclusivity, inclusive decision making, and also transparently. Thanks.
I just want to indicate on the last question asked by Mr. Mare around the intention to amend the competition law. I think if you recall well during our meeting with the department where the DG briefed us, he did indicate, he did respond to that question. Yes, he made it in black and white. If you can revisit your document, he said. Remember when we were requesting for any intention, laws that they're intending to amend, or any new bills that they're intending to come up with. He did respond to this particular one. DG, can you come in? Members, I just want to bring to your attention that there is another, I think it's an attachment to the slide presentation made by the DG. Don't limit yourself to only to what the DG has given you. This is just a document on FED. I've just gone through it. If you'd want to ask questions related to that document, you have to please feel free to do so. Thank you, teacher.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I will respond to some of the positions, and then Mr. Strachan, Dr. Hindle, and Ms. Mohale will add to the answer which I provide. Honorable Marais has posed some questions which I would like to answer, although I think the manner in which the questions were posed does sort of compel me to say that this is my answer. But the answer really is I do acknowledge the independence of the competition authorities. I emphasized it in my presentation that this distinguishes us from many other countries whose executives control the decisions which in our country are made by an independent authority, which I respect and I believe is independent and should remain independent. Having said that, I also express my trust and faith in their impartiality. That does not, however, mean that I would blindly agree with each and every decision that those authorities make. And the legislation provides me with instruments to engage and contest those authorities. And I would hope that in a democracy, under the rule of law, we should be encouraged to use all the instruments available with us to engage and contest should we disagree within the rules of the game. And I believe that everything that has happened is precisely within the rules of the game. Personally, because the question was posed like that, I believe in the remit of those authorities. I do not believe that the executive should have a veto power over the decisions of independent authorities, such as the Competition Commission and Tribunal. But I do believe that the legislation empowers government to engage in particular ways.
Can I interrupt?
Yes.
Although the question might have been asked from you as an individual, but I feel that you are not here representing yourself, you're representing government. And therefore, I think you have a protection, therefore, to continue responding in a way that would represent the view of government and how government approaches.
Okay. I'm certainly not aware of anything within government which is contemplating a veto power. I'm certainly not aware of anything within government that is contemplating that. But the Act does make provision for review of decisions by the tribunal. So everything that's happening is within the remit and ambit of the law. And what's happening, as emphasized in the presentation, is not an appeal by government, it is a review. In terms of how many cases were appealed, I do not have that information at hand, but that is information we could supply to the committee. Now, in terms of the Honorable Mabasa's questions, the first question will be handled by Mr. Strachan. Yeah. I think basically the question is focusing on the challenge which we have pertaining to trying to promote and sustain small businesses and micro businesses this has been a subject of discussion today, as I've already observed. That assumption cannot really be made because there are large and big players, and it is important for government, in order to achieve our various policy objectives, including employment creation, to put in mechanisms that will allow for the advancement of previously disadvantaged historical groups, that will allow for the advancement of small businesses, and that will allow for the protection of existing jobs as well as the creation of new jobs. And that any steps taken to protect these would be in line with broad government policy. Policies would need to narrow the gap, the social inequality gap, which the Honourable Member refers to. And interventions in proceedings or processes like the ones under review in these hearings broadly do or may require particular interventions within the ambit of the law. And my suggestion all along is that all the interventions that have been made are within the ambit of the law. And they are indeed motivated by the public interest issues, which I've again reiterated, which government policy needs to protect, and which need to also obviously be a consequence, therefore, of the implementation of government policy. I think that my colleagues will also elaborate upon that question, as well as the first question posed by the Honourable Marais. So perhaps we could go in the order I suggested, Mr. Strachan, Dr. Hindle, Mr. Sibola, if he wants to add as well, and Ms. Mohali. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In response to Member Marais' question, I have to say that we're not aware of the specifics of this particular case and therefore wouldn't want to comment on those specifics in the absence of a detailed understanding of the nature of the transaction. But I could undertake as soon as possible to furnish the committee with that information, even though it seems to me it falls under probably the Department of Minerals resources. What we could say without fear of contradiction is that government would be strongly opposed to a transaction where central to the transaction is the notion that beneficiation would take place abroad. As Member Marais knows very well, beneficiation of minerals is central to the industrial policy action plan. And the Department of Trade and Industry has intervened without fear or favour in other instances, and the most recent example would be the takeover of a South African company, Free World, by a Japanese multinational, Kansai, and where we thought that the interests of our production sector in coatings, paint and automotive coatings was threatened, including with respect to intellectual property. We made submissions to the Competitions Commission. It wasn't to the tribunal because this was a mid-level category and not a large merger and acquisition. And in fact, as it's a matter of public record that the Competition Commission ruled in a certain sense in our favor, and very strong conditions were imposed on Kansai, including divestiture of its automotives, of the Free World automotives component of that at
in fact an article that was published in the media, so there's nothing new in it. But I do believe it's important, and probably the first two paragraphs we'd really like to encourage the members just to concentrate on. It gives, I think, some very concrete meat to the statement that was made in the presentation about food security concerns and the idea that if your value chains disintegrate, it has very serious downstream consequences. Broadly, it spells out in 2007, where we had a milk shortage in the country, that in the end was the consequence of what seemed like very nice short-term benefits. We found that we could import cheaper milk from overseas, and suppliers did so, and consumers welcomed it, and it seemed to be a good thing. And then all of a sudden, we had international drought conditions, the price of milk overall went up, there were shortages internationally. Suddenly we found that many of our dairy farmers had in fact gone under by then, so not only had we lost jobs in that period, but in fact the downstream, the eventual consequence, was that we ended up paying in fact more for our milk than we had been previously. So it just gives a sense of what these things are and appeals to us, I suppose, to look at the bigger picture and not to be seduced by what could be very short-term immediate benefits, but really to understand the bigger consequences for the economy, for consumers, for the country as a whole. I think that's all I need to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Sibola, you want to say something?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think without going into the details and also to be in line with your guidance around the discussions here, I suffice to say that the department promotes local production as well as local agro-processing. So I think in brief, that's how we all face it.
Are you interfering or are you intervening? Complimenting. Okay, you want to come in?
Thank you, Chair. I just want to supplement or complement the inputs of my colleagues. My colleague, Mr. Strachan, made mention of government's views and efforts with regards to beneficiation. I wanted to confirm that the beneficiation strategy has been released, in fact, for public comment, and that the work there is being conducted in a interdepartmental process where the EDD and the DTI will be involved with the DMR on work on beneficiation. Furthermore, that in fact the views expressed by Mr. Strachan are very much in line with the approach of the government with regards to our engagements with trading partners. The Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Agreement with China makes explicit mention of the need for beneficiation close to source, and so that will be followed up, but that it is in contradiction. Honourable Marais' other question was with regards to FDI, and I just wanted to make the, it was production sectors or productive sectors versus other sectors for investment. I wanted to flag at that point that the new growth path, and when I did come to present with the Director General in late 2009, I presented a slide from the IPAP document, which juxtaposed backwards linkages with employment intensity, and that is to say exactly which sectors have the most meaningful value chain linkages and multiplier effects in terms of investment, as well as employment effects of their investments. And so it's within that rubric which we are able to make informed yet difficult the decisions when it comes to sectoral breakdowns.
Thank you very much. The question still stands. Are you interfering or are you intervening? No. Government. Why really do you want to do this? Why do you want to interfere in the business where you should be leaving the market to take control?
I refer to the Competition Act. Section 18(1) of the Act empowers the Minister for Economic
received from the Minister of Department of Agriculture. It's inconsistent with all the presentations that came before us here, and especially the emphasis on job losses and the national debt of SMEs, and the particular position that was referred to. I mean, if you read it, you will see that the backstop is government. So if all of us could understand in that way, and the public out there not be deceived by the short-term benefits, but look in the long-term, the detrimental impact of the whole process.
That was a comment, ma'am. Thank you very much. It doesn't require any response. Thank you very much for the presentation and enlightenment into various issues, especially where we did not understand as different presenters came in and left. Thank you very much. And this brings us to the end of our public hearings. Of course, people were asking us what's next after this. And I'm going to say the internal legislature processes will take their course. And as usual, I think we do our things in a very transparent manner. We will be issuing our programs, agenda, so that people know, including the media, when we'll be deliberating on this particular hearings, that which then will lead us to the development of our report, and that report will then be tabled before the parliament. As I said yesterday, that report will be decided upon by parliament whether it gets debated or not, or it passes through Parliament without being debated. But otherwise, we will do our work as a committee, as we are expected to do. If there's a need for further engagement, the committee will decide and request permission to do so. If allowed, then we will further engage. Thank you very much for your attendance and your patience. Thanks to the committee members, especially that they were called from their recess and they were able to come and participate. Other members, unfortunately, could not stay longer because they had to go back to finalize their constituency work. I know, Mr. Mare, tomorrow you'll have another day because in our calendar, we're working Monday to Monday. So we do our constituency work even during the weekend. So if we can then go back and finalize that constituency work, and remember that from next week, Tuesday, is the committee week, and then we'll be commencing with our committee work. Thank you very much. The hearing is adjourned.